Photographer and activist Nan Golden has shared intimate details of her life through her work. She's photographed her sex life. She's created self-portraits taken in the aftermath of a violent domestic assault with her ex-boyfriend. But while those pictures were taken by Nan herself, in a new documentary, the photographer passes the camera off to Academy Award-winning director Laura Poitras to tell the story of Nan's struggle with opioid addiction and her resulting activism against the Sackler family, the family whose enormous wealth comes in part from OxyContin. Nan is the founder of Prescription Addiction Intervention Now, or PAIN. It's a group that has had massive success targeting museums who've accepted Sackler donations. You might remember their protests at the Guggenheim in 2019 or at the Met in 2018. Nan's activism set off a new way to hold the Sacklers accountable. And because of the work of PAIN and Nan's putting her own career on the line, both the Guggenheim and the Met, as well as other museums around the world, have removed the Sackler name from their walls and galleries, and others have refused to accept Sackler donations. It was an effective strategy to delegitimize the Sackler name in the arts and culture world and bring more international attention to the opioid crisis. The documentary, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, follows Nan's life, career, art, and activism. It's directed by Laura Poitras and won the prestigious Golden Lion Award at the Venice Film Festival this year. It is playing in theaters today. Laura Poitras, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's really great to be here with you today.
So there's some footage that was filmed before you came on board. Nan had already begun working on having her activism documented. What did you see in the footage that interested you and helped you think about this as possibly a bigger film?
Yeah, I mean, like as you sort of said in your introduction, the work that PAIN was doing was kind of just using the museum space as a sort of cultural battlefield to talk about the failures of this country to address the overdose crisis, mm-hmm. and particularly to hold the Sackler family accountable for their role in it, for their role in fueling it. And, you know, for those who don't know, the Sackler family are known as these sort of art philanthropists. Mm-hmm. They have wings at the Metropolitan Museum, at the Louvre, at the Tate. And, you know, and so the family were moving in these sort of very elite art circles and yet sort of being very discreet about where their money comes from, and which, you know, we learn in the film and we've learned through the reporting of many journalists, comes from the sale of OxyContin, yeah, and which they introduced late 90s, was known to be being abused and killing people in the early 2000s. So this is something we've known about for a long time and that journalists have been covering. And yet the government did nothing. Politicians did nothing for years and years and literally decades of no action. And so Nan makes the decision to use her substantial power in the art world to shame them and get their names taken off of these museum walls. And so we met for breakfast in 2019 around another art world scandal. The sort of, you know, there's the theme of art washing, washing of blood money in art institutions is a lot of people have been talking about recently. And she told me that she documented her actions, and I was really just thrilled as a you know, citizen. I was thrilled, and as a documentary filmmaker, I was still thrilled to know that she had the story behind the scenes recorded. And then in that conversation, she said she was looking for producers, and ultimately I volunteered to join the project.
And I wanted, you know, we've had Patrick Radden Keefe on the show for Empire of PAIN. We did like a 2-hour interview with him. So I think a lot of us are very familiar with it. We'll talk a little bit more about his reporting and how it dovetails with Nan's story in a minute.
Yeah.
Nan is obviously someone who is used to being in control of imagery and the camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What conversations did you have with her about what it would mean to really pass over quite a bit of control to you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like it's important to say that this is the film is a collaboration with Nan. Nan mm-hmm. began the film. She's a producer on the film. She's consulted every step of the way in the film. It's dealing with her story. So the film doesn't exist without Nan's collaboration every step of the way. You know, in a way that was, it was clear that kind of level of collaboration was always going to be part of this film and was also exciting because here is an artist whose work I've loved for years and to be able to have the opportunity to work with her. And we set up, you know, there was lots of different things that we that we put in place to assure that she would have opportunities to review things. And what happened is that, you know, when she was, first of all, we worked for until we had a rough cut, and then she came and had notes, and we started working with them, and it wasn't that she was wanted to take anything out of the film. It was like, I want to add more, like there needs to be more depth around a lot of issues. And so that going back and forth and working with her and throughout the process. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we both talked about, we're both, fierce, independent, stubborn, artists. And it's incredible. Both responsibility and, privilege to be entrusted to tell the story.
What is your process when you do have a disagreement with a collaborator? How do you work through it? How do you resolve disagreements creatively?
It depends case by case. I mean, a lot of sometimes it was just like, we need to go deeper. Like Nan was like, we need to talk deeper about this subject, you know, and then it wasn't really a disagreement. It was like, it wasn't truthful or fully truthful. And so we would, go back in. I mean, and that was, most of the cases. But she also knew, as the director on the film, I had final cut of over the film, and she was very respectful of that as well.
My guest is Laura Poitras. The name of the film is All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. It is in theaters today. The film deals with Nan's life and career, but we learn a lot about her family. Her family is very much a part of this. And her sister, Barbara Golden, who died by suicide after a long period in and out of mental health facilities. The title of the film actually comes from something you and Nan found in Barbara's medical records. What is the context for that phrase, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed? And why did it feel like the right title for this film?
Yeah, we've been working on the film for a while. We didn't have a title, which often happens. You sort of are waiting for it to emerge. And Nan had shared with me primary documents from the hospitals where Barbara had been institutionalized. And I was at home reading them. And there was one document that describes a Rorschach test. And the person who's writing the Rorschach test or writing Barbara's responses, she writes, it's a longer sentence, but she sees the future and all the beauty and the bloodshed. And I just remember sort of stepping back and thinking that this was really somewhat haunting and also reflecting something what I hope the film was about. That it's not just the kind of tragedy that we know of in the film of the overdose crisis and what Nan talks about in terms of the AIDS crisis, but that there is a through line of fierce resistance and rejection of, the cruelty of American society and the cruelty of systems of non-accountability where billionaires walk away with things and that people resist against it or then they fight against it. And that the film celebrates that sort of resistance and finding alternative paths in this society. And then I went to see Nan and I just read it to her. I explained the context and I repeated the line, it's like that I thought that All the Beauty and the Bloodshed felt like the title. And there was no hesitation. She was immediately like, knew that it was right. It was right for what it was communicating, that it was connected to her sister, who, Nan has dedicated, her art to her sister.
When you think about Nan's work, how does she bring her sense of art to her activism? And her artistry to activism?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'll do a best. Like I always be careful to answer for Nan, but I think.
Well, how would you observe? Yeah, you're someone you watch. I mean, as filmmakers and journalists, we observe and we process.
Yes. I mean, there are some similarities in the sense that she didn't, I think she was felt catapulted into it. She came out of rehab from an oxy addiction, and then she reads Patrick Radden Keefe's essay in The New Yorker, and he lays out the connection between the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, and she's just like, how is it that this this name that I know from the art world mm-hmm. is connected to, you know, all this death. And then she just kind of, you know, barrels forward. It's so quickly, you know, she immediately decides to write this essay in art form where she talks, she just basically like declares war against the Sacklers. Like, we're coming after you. We're coming mm-hmm. after your philanthropy. We're coming after you. And then they start doing the protests soon after. So it's, you know, they're, you know, and you know, one could say, you know, I think Nan and I agree that art is separate from activism, but that there is definitely a strong component to Payne's actions that are, you know, informed by the fact that the group is largely artists, and also informed by the fact that the group is composed of people who've been affected by mm-hmm. The overdose crisis, that they directly have experience with this, and so that kind of urgency, I think, is, you know, fuels the demonstrations in the same way, like, you know, in the film, like David Wonderovich and his, you know, his writing and his rage, you know, sort of fuel his writing. I mean, people, you know, the stakes couldn't be higher. I mean, people are dying, so there is that sense of energy that happens in these protests, and I think Nan is also. Would be the first one to always credit her collaborators, you know, that she, the ideas were all arrived at as a collective, you know, they non-hierarchical and, you know, the importance of like sharing credit for her, the impact of those actions.
It's interesting just listening to you answer really, and I guess I should have realized this before, Nan Golden is a unique conduit
yeah.
between the opioid crisis and the art world and the funding yeah. of the art world. And she's important in the art world. And she's had this individual, personal, very personal, nearly lost her life, nearly overdosed experience. Yeah. So she really, you know, it's an overused phrase. She's a little bit of a unicorn. Like, I'm not sure there, you know, who else could have pulled this off in some ways.
Right. Yeah. I Megan Kapler, who's, in you meet in the film, like, I think she referred to her, you know, as a multiple threat, you know, that mm-hmm. she was an artist who's collected by all the museums. So she's, you know, they have to sort of listen to her, and she has, you know, bodily experience of this drug, and that, you know, she kind of, you know, she leverages it all against them, you know, like very strategically. She was uniquely positioned. I think Patrick would very much agree with that. Like, you couldn't have imagined a better antagonist to the Sacklers than Nan Golden.
The name of the film is All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. It is in theaters today. I'm speaking with its director, Laura Poitras. So Nan was involved in the AIDS activism movement in the city during the ACT UP era. Do you see parallels between her work then and how she has approached the Sackler protest?
I think for sure there are parallels, and we hopefully draw them in the film. I mean, there's sort of two levels of parallels. There's a sort of societal parallels mm-hmm. where you have the United States failing to do something to protect people, right? The failure of the FDA, you know, the loss of its generations, you know, so there's those societal failures. And then you have, you know, Nan with her personal, but, you know, like experiencing them both, like experiencing the loss of her community to the AIDS crisis, and then experiencing the loss of another other generations today and the overdose crisis. So we wanted to put these historical moments in conversation with each other. Like that mm-hmm. I feel like hopefully the film is a societal critique, and hopefully the film sort of fights against ideas of amnesia, right? That we tend to forget things, and the importance of sort of remembering, you know, like this, the other histories and putting them in dialogue with each other was really important to me as a filmmaker. And again, it's like Nan is able to do that with such authority because she's experienced mm-hmm. the devastation of the failure of the society that we live in.
I was gonna ask, what did you want to explore about
grief and loss, because Nan almost lost her life. She lost her sister to suicide. Many of the people in pain have lost friends to the opioid addiction, obviously friends she's lost through AIDS. What did you want to explore about grief and loss?
Right. I mean, on one hand, I think it was a really important that what Nan shares with, you know, with the audience in the film and what's included, you know, that there's a reason that it's there and that it's not just because of the loss and the trauma, but hopefully to achieve some, you know, shifts. And, you know, one of them being like, you know, the you know, shame needs to be placed where it belongs, you know, which is like on, you know, the boardrooms and the Sackler family and the people who are responsible for this crisis. And you know, then yet on the other hand, you have the Sacklers trying to, like, you know, hammer on the abusers. I mean, that's the narrative that they try to use. And so it's like, I think, you know, that through this, you know, talking about these ideas of loss, it's also redirecting accountability. And also, you know, to memorialize people. I think Nan's work has sought to do that. And there is almost certain themes in the film that I also think are almost sacred. Like I want the film to speak because of the, you know, level of devastation and loss, and that the film articulates those.
The Sacklers are a powerful family with a lot of money to spend on the legal fees. Did you have any concerns about the Sacklers intervening, about the documentary, responding to the documentary in a legal way? What kind of legal counsel did you have?
Sure. We had lots of conversations with lawyers, as did, you know, Patrick and any investigative journalist who's writing about a powerful family and that have lots of resources and play dirty. And, you know, Payne also had those conversations. The tactic that is often used is, you know, you have an army of lawyers that threaten people and intimidate. Patrick talks about, like, getting weekly, you know, letters of, of threatening once he announced he was writing the book. You also have the use of private investigators, you know, sort of intimidation. You know, Patrick, you know, has some, you know, SUV lurking outside of his house, and so does Nan. And, you know, those kind of, like, dirty, you know, intimidation tactics are what, you know, billionaire or wealthy people do, and to intimidate and try to get you to stop telling the story. And, you know, obviously Nan wasn't going to stop, and I certainly wasn't going to, you know, let that kind of pressure. But individually, did I get legal threats? We didn't. I don't know that I decided that it was strategically good to keep a bit of a low profile that I was making the film. And partly because I wanted to keep, you know, not, you know, sort of invite those legal threats. But they haven't personally sent the kind of letters that Patrick got and that you see in the film.
Did you approach the Sacklers for an interview?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We approached them for comment. We approached them for comment.
And yeah, their response was?
You know, it's in the end of the film. You know, you learn in the film that the Sacklers, and there are thousands of lawsuits are mounting up across the state. One of the biggest, I think, bigger than tobacco. And then they, you know, they have this sort of like escape hatch where they file for bankruptcy. But before filing for bankruptcy, the family siphons out all the money out of the company, over $10 billion. And you know, so but the family doesn't file for bankruptcy. I mean, it's like obscenely corrupt. And you know, this idea of sort of billionaire justice system. And so I asked them about the money that they took from the company, and they said that they had, you know, they acknowledged that they took the money out of the company, but that it was reinvested in other companies, and they pay taxes, was their response.
The film is not linear. It jumps around between telling Nan's life story, following the trajectory of pain, the activism, exploring Nan's work. How did you land on this structure?
Yeah, it's a collaboration with a really amazing group of editors, and felt that I didn't want to do anything that was sort of a traditional biography film. I always knew that the activism thread would be kind of the one of the main engines that sort of drove the film forward. But then it became clear, sort of after I started working on the film, the importance that it go into Nan's history and also her artwork. You know, that we bring those parts of her her life into the film, and you know, partly because I think it informs the, you know, what drives her. I think this, you know, refusal to accept the kind of denialism of, you know, the society that we're living in, and that she sort of has repeatedly kind of stood up against those forces, was important for me to tell in the film.
I talked to Patrick Radenkief about this, and I'm curious your thoughts on it. Why is the removal of the Sackler name potent? Mm-hmm. Why is that something that would matter to this family?
Right, right. I mean, you know, it's there's a few different answers to that. I mean, one is, I mean, in terms of for the family, you know, that's where their reputation, where they sort of like, you know, the world that they lived in. I mean, it was going after something that they really cared dearly about, their position in the art world. So it's going after something that they truly care about. But in terms of its, like, you know, impact in society, I mean, there is a way that, you know, the cultural spaces have become battlegrounds. Mm-hmm. To and there are limitations to what can be accomplished, right? You don't get structural change, you know, in the cultural institutions, but it also reveals this kind of failure in other parts of society, right? That, you know, that cultural institutions are like a resort that people can use because we have the failure of the government and to address catastrophic situations. Mm-hmm. And so it is meaningful, right? You know, I mean, it's incredibly meaningful that the name was taken down and that battle was won. And yet it's also very much a story about impunity because the Sacklers ultimately get away with it. They ultimately, you know, have, you know, they signed an agreement, a bankruptcy agreement that protects them and all of their, you know, trusts and associates from, you know, future lawsuits. You know, it's like it gives them immunity, and that's really a really terrifying lesson, right? Mm-hmm. Given the facts that are known about how OxyContin was known to be, how they promoted it,
right,
willfully, and knowing people were dying, and then thought about how they could make more money. You know, so you know. The film, you know, tries to show, you know, both of those things, that yet, you know, they get away with it and yet they do pay a price.
The film won the Golden Lion at Venice this year, which I understand is rare for a documentary to win. What did that mean for you, to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the most incredible moments for me as a filmmaker. It was selected to compete in competition with fiction films, and we were the only nonfiction film. And I was already thrilled with that honor. It felt an honor because I believe in the importance of understanding nonfiction as cinema. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's storytelling, that we're we should be, you know, considered at the by the same terms in that sense. So I was thrilled to be in competition and never even imagined, you know, that it could win. And so I'm still a little bit in shock and disbelief, it's really meaningful.
The name of the film is All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. It is in theaters today. I was speaking with its director, Laura Poitras. Laura, thank you for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.